Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. This week it's a full arts spread with opera, literature, sculpture, and a film about a family that helped lay the foundation for punk rock. The documentary, A Band Called Death, has been called one of the best music documentaries in years, and today I talk with its co-director, Jeff Howlett. Then Bethany Chafin opens the book on the Press 53 short story collection In the Season of Blood and Gold with its author, Taylor Brown. Next, David Ford takes in the Wetherspoon Art Museum's exhibition, Nancy Rubens, Drawing, Sculpture, Studies, with curator of exhibitions, Zandra Eden, and Wetherspoon director, Nancy Dahl. Then we'll revisit David Ford's conversation with the late opera composer and former UNCSA chancellor, Dr. Robert Ward. All that coming up when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. On today's program, we have composer Robert Ward, the large-scale sculptures of artist Nancy Rubens, and a conversation with author Taylor Brown. But how about we start off with a kind of story that keeps you going back to the record store? So before the punk rock explosion of the mid-1970s, there was A Band Called Death. That's the name of the music documentary co-directed by my guest, Charlotte, North Carolina filmmaker Jeff Howlett.
Nobody was making music like that in 73.
Three black brothers from Detroit, Michigan.
What were they called?
They were called Death.
That's a good name.
Have you lost your mind?
The film explores the musical and personal relationships of the Hackney brothers and their proto-punk band, Death. The band formed in a Detroit bedroom in the early 1970s, and the brothers recorded an album in 74 that collected dust until being released in 2009. Howlett's film traces the brothers' journey from obscurity to critical success, a journey that took over 30 years. You can see the film right now on Blu-ray and streaming on Netflix, and you can catch the band live in North Carolina at this year's Hopscotch Music Festival in Raleigh on September 6th. I spoke to Jeff via phone from his office in Charlotte, but first, a little music. This song's called Rock and Roll Victim and comes courtesy of A Band Called Death. I expected to be excited about the music and learning about this band, but I didn't know just how in-depth we were going to get with the family and where it was going to go. It was such an incredible story about unheard music seeing the light of day, but it was really as much, if not more, a testament to the power of family and faith. Did you expect it would go in that direction when you set out to make it?
Just from the relationship I established then and just talking to fellows over the years, I just knew that there was a deep family story there, and just talking to other family members and everyone having so much affection and love for their brother David, we all just talked about this is a bigger story than your rockumentary, if you will. This is a family story. This is a spiritual story, you know. So it just evolved. I felt honored to be able to tell the story.
All you false pretenders and your freaky contenders trying to be the first. In my own opinion, you I'm not defending. You are the worst.
And it's crazy listening to the music. It's like it sounds like something that it has that sound of inspiring so many things that came after it. It's really kind of mind-blowing.
When I first heard the track, I was like, this is something that I've heard before. I, you know, just being a fan of punk and proto-punk and listening to Iggy and the Stooges and MC5 and Bad Brains, and this just sounded so familiar.
So you knew Bobby Sr. He had never mentioned Death ever to you, correct?
Never. I felt the same way that Julia, like, you know, as Julia mentions in the documentary, like, Dad, why didn't you tell me? I was the same way. Bob, why didn't you tell me about this band?
You know, when I saw Alice Cooper, it was like, you know, all bets are off, man. To me, if we ain't playing this, then I ain't gonna be having no fun.
Rock and roll just kind of, we just kind of immersed ourselves in it. That's what David called it. He said, it's pure rock and roll, man. Not like, you're gonna have your one hit, but the pure rock and roll is what they don't play over the radio.
In the film, they talk about the Detroit sound and Motown and that sort of thing. And do you have any idea of, were they influenced by other things going on in Detroit as far as, you know, Iggy and the Stooges, MC5, that sort of thing? Or were they just coming up with this on their own based on their separate inspirations?
David actually saw MC5 in 67, and so he was really inspired by MC5. Not so much musically, but just like, you know, it was just such a happening and an energetic band. And, you know, and then obviously listening to the Stooges and stuff like that, they definitely acknowledge that. But Rockfire Funk Express was the funk band that they had started in 72, 73. So they actually issued a 7-inch recently on Jack White's Third Man Records label that just came out. So it was Dennis seeing Alice Cooper, telling his brothers, and then basically a couple months later when David went and saw The Who, it was like, we got to play this kind of music. There is no other music than this. This is what we're playing. And him as sort of the band leader, I mean, okay, you're in charge. Let's do this. Let's write this music. And so, you know, it was just going off of sort of what they had heard and just sort of making it up as they went along. You know, they're all self-taught musicians.
David had a slogan. He said, if I could play chords like Peter Townsend and play lead like Jimi Hendrix, I am the ideal guitar player.
It's pretty amazing. Some of the, the guitar work. I mean, I've talked to other guitar players, and you know, Vernon Reid and Wayne Kramer and stuff about his guitar playing. And I mean, it's just, you know, they're like, you know, he's solid. He's a solid player.
He's solid. And his tone is incredible too. I mean, it's the kind of tone people are really trying to reach. I mean, it's just like the amps are on the right over the edge of breaking up, and it's so dynamic his playing.
Even if you listen to some of the demo stuff, I mean, there's the Spiritual Mental Physical album on Drag City Records as well, which is, you know, mainly just demos where they just sort of stuck a mic in the room, did all 4-track stuff. Even that is just phenomenal. I mean, it's just, yeah, the tone is there, you know, it's just his Marshall stack, you know, and the way he had it configured and set up. Just had it dialed.
Yeah.
Just right.
Bobby was in school, I was at work. So when we get home, David says, man, I got this great, great new idea for the name of the band. So he holds us in suspense. Let's run up to the room and find out what this great name is that David then came up with. We're waiting with much suspense, and as soon as he says, yeah, this is the name, dude. Death.
Death. Oh, man.
So me and Bobby just kind of looked at each other as if to say, this dude's gone way off the deep end. I know what I would do if somebody came up to me talking about their band, the name of their band was Death. I'm like, I don't want to hear it. But there again, that old thing in the back of your head kicks in, back up your brother, back up your brother.
David always said that our name would have shock value. And we're like, why would you say that? He says, because death is real.
He had so much conviction, so much belief, until we just went along with it.
And that was right around the spring of 1974. Yeah, that's when we became Death.
As a leader, he had, and you know, when people check out the film, they'll see all the great ideas and his concepts on the band and, you know, the artwork and everything. But with the band being called Death at that time, and with those three guys, I mean, his vision was so strong that he wouldn't even change the name for Clive Davis. And for listeners that might not know who he is, Clive Davis signed Bruce Springsteen, Pink Floyd, Patti Smith. I was watching this and listening to Dennis and Bobby talk about it, and you know, I was getting frustrated along with them, but ultimately there was something so genuine and just beautiful about his belief in their music and their concept, and in a really, you know, punk rock way of no compromises.
He stood his ground.
Yeah.
You know, for his brothers and himself, you know, he said, you know, I'm not changing our name for anyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's just a true believer in the art of music, you know. I mean, it's just a true testament to that if they take this, if they take my name, they take my identity, is the way that David saw things. Mm. And, I mean, I admire that.
I got this setting with Clive Davis, and it caused a very interesting stir because they were really focused on this record and they wanted to get involved in it.
The first reaction was, hey, this, yeah, it's great stuff.
Possibly we may be on the brink of a deal, but there's one sticking point. Clive Davis expressed that he really didn't care for the name of the band.
Brian had told us, he said, you guys might have a record deal if you are willing to change the name.
That sent David into another place because he had his death concept, and the concept went with the name, and the band went with the concept, and nothing could change.
David, in no uncertain terms, just said, tell Clive Davis to go to hell.
Okay, so David, our illustrious leader, turned the deal down.
As a fellow artist, I commend him for that, and I know it's his brothers do now, but I know that back then, in the 70s, it was definitely a struggle that,
sure,
you know, hey, David's in charge here, but we're going to back up our brother.
Yeah, that commitment to each other really comes through, and it's really, really touching.
See, we grew up in the black community, so at that time, people were tuning in to like groups like Earth, Wind & Fire.
And, you know, here we are in the middle of all of this playing rock and roll.
And, I mean, it wasn't a rock and roll culture.
White boy music.
I mean, the more people tried to talk to us about changing, I think the deeper we went into rock and roll.
Watch those things now!
They're three black guys making this music in the early 70s. It seemed like it was more like the name that kept them out. I mean, do you think, though, that they did have a hard time distributing themselves because of their race and, you know, the style of music they were playing?
It could have had a factor. I mean, the big factor was the neighbors in the neighborhood. I mean, they were expecting, you know, the guys to play some Motown music, and they were really pissing them off playing this heavy driving, hard rock and roll.
Yeah.
We spoke with Wayne Kramer about this, and he said if Death played, like, open for us at the Grand Ballroom in Detroit, it would have been a whole different story.
Wow, yeah.
It's amazing to hear something that like that from Wayne, and to know that, you know, it would have been or could have been something a lot different than what it is today, you know. So it could, you know, the album they recorded, that United Sounds for the Whole World to See, could have came out in 76, you know.
Everyone seems so comfortable around you. I mean, as a filmmaker, was there anything you did or tried to make them feel so comfortable to open up, or, you know, was it just natural?
You know, to be honest, it just became natural, you know. Sometimes we had done a couple interviews that are in the film, you know. We had gotten to a point where Mark and I just became part of the family. Just through the process, you just get to a comfort level where nothing's off the table. Everything's in the open. There's interviews that sort of thread throughout the entire film of Bobby and Dennis when they're, you know, wearing their death, the blue jackets and stuff.
Yeah.
Those interviews each for 10 to 12 hours. I had actually sat down with Bob and I said, look, we're going to ask you everything. This interview is going to be a very long interview. Here's 5 or 6 pages of questions, and we're going to go through it all. And he said, okay, let's do this. Like, we had one break for pizza, and that was it.
How long were you with them total in the process of making the film?
Sure, the process of making the film was 3 years of production and a year of post-production. Mm.
Let me ask you, is this your first feature-length film?
This is my first feature-length film, and it's my co-director, Mark's second.
How is that working with a co-director?
I think it's really important, especially for this project, to have a co-director, because I sort of acted as a director-producer, just because I have a family, and I couldn't get to all the shoots. And so Mark, he jumped right in, and actually we filmed almost every interview, excluding Henry Rollins and Wayne Kramer. It was just a natural thing for him to become my co-director.
How did the family react when they saw the film?
The family was just completely blown away. I mean, I know that when we played the entire film for the family and our crew, it was just a very emotional experience. I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. It was such an emotional thing. I mean, I know to this day that when Bobby and Dennis go see this movie, it brings tears to their eyes. It's still a very emotional ride for them. It's just amazing that you're able to tell the story and make them happy too as a family.
Charlotte-based filmmaker Jeff Howlett. His film, A Band Called Death, can be seen right now on Netflix or on Blu-ray. Death just released the album Death 3, which compiles their remaining unreleased music. The band Death, with new guitarist Bobby Duncan, have been on tour in support of the film and their recordings, and recently stopped by the Arsenio Hall show for a blistering performance. You can catch them at this year's Hopscotch Music Festival in Raleigh, North Carolina, on September 6th. Visit WFDD.org for links to performances and a trailer for the film A Band Called Death. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia. It's time for a break, but when we return, Bethany Chafin explores the short story collection In the Season of Blood and Gold with author Taylor Brown when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia, in for David Ford. Coming up, we have a look at the work of American artist Nancy Rubens and a tribute to former University of North Carolina School of the Arts Chancellor Dr. Robert Ward. But up next, Triad Arts Associate Producer Bethany Chafin has a conversation with author Taylor Brown.
Taylor Brown's debut collection of short fiction comes out this Saturday, May 3rd. In the Season of Blood and Gold, published by Press 53, includes 12 stories of dynamic characters and timeless landscapes. From alligator wrestlers to Confederate soldiers, to a tattoo artist exploring the map to her heart and to her mother's. The collection is impressive. Writer Charles Dodd has said, "With ferocious economy and a great big heart, Taylor Brown writes one of the best debuts I've ever picked up. These are stories, verses, meditations, and accusations, everything in short you could hope to get from important fiction. This work demands your attention." Taylor is the winner of the Montana Prize in Fiction for the first story in the collection, Writer, and World Without End was a recent finalist for the Doris Betts Fiction Prize. His work has appeared in numerous publications, including the Coachella Review, Story South, and the Baltimore Review. A native of the Georgia coast, Taylor now resides in Wilmington, North Carolina. He stopped by the studios of WFDD on a recent trip to Winston-Salem, and I began by asking him when and how his interest in writing began.
In my first grade class, in Miss Pruitt's class, she gave us these, they were newsprint sheets, and the bottom half was ruled and the top half wasn't, and we wrote a story every day and illustrated it. Like, as I remember it, at least, we did this every single day. And I think that it started for me really there because I really took to that. I really, really enjoyed that. A contest came up, and I had written this story about a spider that steals a remote control car on Christmas. And I don't remember all the specifics. That was pretty much the premise of the story, though. And so Mrs. Pruitt submitted it, and it one at the school, and then at one at the county level, and I guess they sent it off to the state, and we never heard about it after that. So I guess, you know, didn't win anything there. But I think after that, that I really took to it. It was something that came naturally to me that I really enjoyed. And before that and after, my mom talks about how I was just always making up stories, and that I would follow her around the house telling her these really, really long tales that I'd made up about, you know, why my Triceratops toy had rocket launchers on its back, or, you know, why my G.I. Joes had the little holes in the heels, you know, so that they could stand. But for me, they were, you know, rocket boosters. And so anyways, I guess it started pretty early for me.
Noticing the fact that your G.I. Joes have holes in the feet and stuff like that, that seems astute for a young kid. And then you let your imagination kind of take off. Do some of your stories sort of begin with an observation that you make or someone you know, and then grow from there? Or does your inspiration come from all different sorts of corners?
For me, I find some little detail in everyday life or in a book or somewhere, and maybe it's an image, or it's a lot of the time it's a phrase or a word. It's something like that. It's just a small nugget, and then the whole story grows out of that. For instance, I have a story that's not in this collection, but you know, it's called Cajun Reeboks, and it's because a lot of shrimpers and fishermen wear those white rubber boots, and they call them Cajun Reeboks. And the whole story was from me learning that term. And my favorite stories usually start with something really small that I can't get out of my head or just really interests me. And I know there's a story there, and I just sit down and it just starts, well, you know, hopefully it just starts happening.
So when you find that nugget or idea that you think has a lot of potential, you said you sit down and you start writing. Is that writing notes? Is that writing ideas for research you need to do? Or do you just go for it?
When it comes to a short story, I usually pretty much sit down and go for it. You know, I try to put myself in the same place, the same time of day, you know, have a ritual when it comes to writing. And I'm a big believer in cues and prompts like that, that if you put yourself in that same place every day, that the inspiration will come. And so I don't really worry too much about things like inspiration. And once it gets rolling and you have that momentum, then there's not too much to worry about. But I typically don't start with any notes. I definitely don't outline a story for me, a short story. I don't know how it's going to end when it starts, unless it starts with an ending. You know, some stories start with the ending, but then I don't know what the beginning is, you know. But I definitely am a big believer, and I forget who said it, but someone said writing is like driving at night, you know, with the headlights on. You can only see 30 feet ahead, but you can, you know, you can get all the way there. Writing short story for me is very much like that.
What writers inspire you and why?
I would say Faulkner and McCarthy are my two favorites. And then I do end up gravitating toward a lot of Southern writers. And I know a lot of people, that's always a question, or people are sometimes defensive. I'm not just a Southern writer that just happened to live in the South. And I agree with that. But for whatever reason, maybe it's the language, it's the people, it's the settings. But, you know, let's Ron Rash, Pinckney Benedict, Chris Offutt. There's just so many that I really, really enjoy that, you know, are from Georgia or North Carolina or Virginia or Kentucky or West Virginia. And Barry Hanna is another one. I gravitate toward a lot of these writers that write about a South that's populated more with PBR than mint juleps, because I'm not sure that mint julep South really exists anymore. It does exist, but it's kind of a caricature of itself. Those are settings and a language and a dialogue that I just have an affinity for, you know, that I gravitate to. But, you know, when I was a kid growing up, there were a lot of books in my household, but I didn't grow up in a necessarily bookish or literary household. I remember my parents reading a lot at night. And when I was growing up, I just read whatever was on the shelves. I think one thing that led me to write was I was actually born with club feet on both sides. And in a really high percentile in terms of the seriousness or acuteness of it. So I've had a bunch of reconstructive surgeries on them. And so, you know, at different times, like when I was in third grade, another time when I was in ninth grade, you know, I had these summers where I'd have a surgery and then I would be home all summer, pretty much laid up on the couch recovering. So I would just read. So I remember reading, you know, I'd read stuff like Jack Higgins, who's a British writer that he wrote The Eagles Landed, but he wrote just a lot of books about, you know, it's commercial fiction, you know, but I probably read every single book he ever wrote, you know, probably 30 plus books. So I would just devour stuff. So it's not like I was always reading, you know, big lofty tomes.
Overall, what struck me about your characters, or the characters that really stuck with me, were the ones that had this very almost intimidating, in some ways needing to be ferocious or just strong in a really epic way, mm-hmm. exterior. And then you show these details about them. For example, I think it's in Bone Valley, mm-hmm. your character, he cuts the plastic rings that keep the six-pack together because he's worried about the sea turtles. Or he buttons his shirt before he goes to wrangle an alligator and, you know, and become soaked in the victim's blood who's been attacked by this alligator. Like, those little details I thought were really captivating. And so that juxtaposition, I guess I'm curious about. Is that something you have fun with, or, you know, you think is almost a part of any character that has to have that dynamic?
That's a really good question. I don't think that I am doing that on purpose necessarily, but I think that it's just, I think people are like that. You know, I think when you talk about the character of the alligator wrestler Hart in Bone Valley, I think I do remember growing up around these characters, you know, these older men who have this very tough exterior. And I think that you get that in a lot of places. That maybe you get it more in the South, because there is more of this kind of masculine culture. And you realize this, but a lot of them are really gentle on the inside, despite that exterior. And that's somehow a really powerful thing to me. Just makes a character interesting to me. You know, if they're just one-sided, then there isn't a whole lot to learn from them. There isn't a whole lot for us. You're not going to feel like you know this person, or like you want to know this person, because they're not going to seem like a real person. I think that most of us have a exterior that we show to a world, and an interior that we don't show so often. You know, we show it to close people around us, and maybe in some moments it gets shown. And maybe I'm trying to find those moments too, where, you know, that a violent, cruel person, the gentleness they have inside comes out, or even the opposite, someone that, you know, does have a gentle exterior, and then at some point, you know, something really tough or even cruel comes out. Because I think those are defining moments, and maybe that's one thing that we're looking for when we're reading, you know, and we're trying to, when we're kind of getting to know a character, you know.
The first and last stories in this collection were inspired by old folk ballads, and I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I'm no musician myself whatsoever. I think that I'm pretty much tone deaf. But given all that, I think that I do have maybe a little bit of a musician's heart or something. I, you know, just certain songs and types of music really speak to me. And I really enjoy these old traditionals, these old blues songs and folk ballads and stuff like that. And so Ryder, the inspiration that for that was the song I Know You Ryder, which is a traditional women's blues song. But, you know, I first was exposed to it through the Grateful Dead, but I think Janis Joplin and Joan Baez, and, you know, if you were to get on Spotify and look up I Know You Ryder, I mean, it would just give you probably 100 different artists that have covered it.
I know you recognize.
For that one, there's these images in it that are really powerful, but, and I don't know if this is what's happened over time, but there isn't that much narrative structure. Like, if you asked me what that song was about, I wouldn't really be able to tell you in any kind of coherent way, but maybe it moved me in a certain way or something, and so I just took the idea of this song as an inspiration for the story. And if you were to listen to the song, I think, and then read the story, you would see echoes of certain images or certain language or something like that. And it's interesting to me because all these old blues songs and ballads and stuff, they get played again and again by different people who change the words every time and give them different meanings and basically do their own version. And so for me, with no musical talent, maybe it's like my version of the song is how I maybe think of it. The same goes for In the Season of Blood and Gold. The inspiration for that song was When First Into This Country. And that song maybe has a little bit more of a plot or actual coherent narrative. To me, it's a boy speaking or a young man, and, you know, he's tried to court this girl unsuccessfully, and he steals a colonel's horse, and he ends up in prison and stuff in the song. But just the idea of that song is where I started with the story.
When first into this country, a stranger I came, I courted a fair maid, Nancy was her name. I courted her for love, for love.
Taylor Brown is the author of the forthcoming short fiction collection In the Season of Blood and Gold, published by Press 53. The collection comes out this Saturday, May 3rd, which also happens to be National Press 53 Day. You can celebrate with the press and Taylor at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro on Saturday from 5 to 9 p.m. Taylor will also be doing a reading at Barnhill's Books in Winston-Salem earlier that day at 2 p.m. Those interested can order a signed copy of In the Season of Blood and Gold from Taylor's website. For the link and to find out more about Taylor Brown and Press 53, visit our website at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
That's Triad Arts Associate Producer Bethany Chafin. Now let's step into the Weatherspoon Art Gallery's exhibition of the works of Nancy Rubens with Triad Arts Executive Producer David Ford as our guide.
American artist Nancy Rubens is best known for her enormous sculptures, which have been commissioned and exhibited all across the country. They're made out of things like boats, airplane parts, and hot water heaters. But Rubens transforms these materials into elegant and even delicate-looking objects of incredible beauty. You'll find them on display alongside her captivating graphite drawings at the Weatherspoon Art Museum in Greensboro. Curator of exhibitions Zandra Eden and Weatherspoon director Nancy Dahl spoke with me about Nancy Rubens' drawing, sculpture, studies. What strikes you most about the large-scale works?
I think the way they defy gravity, the way they engage with the space around it, they really bring the space to life because they're truly three-dimensional. I mean, to really appreciate the piece, you need to walk all the way around it. And that notion of there being a single stem basically supporting the piece with these beautiful boats cantilevering off and gesturing, they become very gestural. And that's what appeals to me about them.
Alongside these, you're showing these captivating graphite drawings, and these are kind of sculptures within themselves. How would you describe it, Nancy?
She uses a soft graphite pencil to cover layer after layer after layer sheets of paper. She lays the paper, it's a heavy watercolor paper, down on the floor of her studio, and she goes over and over and over, as I said, layer and layer of this graphite. And in the end piece, you can see her gestures. The large works are then installed in a way that the paper is actually kind of curled and punched out from behind so that they take on a real relief character to them. They're not just flat on the wall. They truly become sculptures in and of their own right.
There's a lot of motion inherent in them, and the way the light plays off it is really neat.
Yeah, they're very graceful. They kind of flutter and bow and bend across the wall. And a lot of people, when they first come into the gallery and they see the pieces, they think they're made of metal, that they're heavy things that have been installed high, because we actually have several of the pieces very high up on the wall. And then they look at the title plate, or if they're on the tour, and we say, oh, you know, it's just paper and pencil, the most simple, basic artist tools.
Yeah.
They're flabbergasted at how that can be. But it's another instance of the artist just coming up with such an inventive, different way of thinking about how to work with materials and how to make them do something that they don't do, or that they normally, you don't see paper that way. You just don't understand paper that way, or you don't understand graphite that way.
It seems like, curatorially speaking, if that's a word, it would be a lot of fun to put this together. A lot of challenges, probably, but thoughts, considerations going into to laying it all out, and then the interest from your perspective.
The project of making heavy things look light. So in her sculpture, heavy things are raised up into the air where they shouldn't be, and you can't believe that they're up there in this cantilevered display. And then making things that are just light, pieces of paper with drawing on them, look really heavy and very dense and almost threatening sometimes. So that kind of really interesting combination, or they kind of fight with each other in the exhibition as well. There's sort of like a conversation going on.
Weatherspoon Art Museum Curator of Exhibitions Zandra Eden and Weatherspoon Director Nancy Dahl. Nancy Rubens, drawing, sculpture, studies will remain on display at Weatherspoon through Sunday, May 4th, where you can take the last guided public tour from 2 to 2:30 and trace the arc of one of today's foremost sculptors. During the tour, which is free and open to all ages, visitors will see the major sculptural installation Drawings and Hot Water Heaters, graphite drawings from 1975 to present, collages, Nancy Rubens' bronze work, and more. You can view images from the exhibit on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend, where you'll also find links to the remarkable new Weatherspoon, UNCG, and Delmonico Books publication chronicling Rubens' amazing output. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm David Ford.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia. It's time for a short break, but when we return, David Ford pays tribute to the life and legacy of composer and educator Dr. Robert Ward when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We're going to close today's show with David Ford's operatic memorial to composer Dr. Robert Ward.
Of all the many famous American novels and plays that have been converted into operas, The Crucible, based on the Tony Award-winning play of the same name by Arthur Miller, tops the list. The opera composer was Robert Ward, who passed away in April of last year at the age of 96. The Crucible premiered in 1961 and the following year won both the Pulitzer Prize and the New York Music Critics Circle Citation. The allegory weaves a tale of lust, revenge, and power against a backdrop of the Salem witch trials of the late 17th century, but the story remains extremely relevant today. In 2011, Robert Ward was the recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts Opera Honors. He was presented the award by the then University of North Carolina School of the Arts Chancellor John Moucheri. Robert Ward himself was School of the Arts Chancellor from 1967 until 75. He spoke with me just ahead of the 2012 Piedmont Opera production of The Crucible.
Do I say that I found my daughter and niece dancing in the forest like heroes?
You referenced a few things you were proud of from your tenure. Tell me about a couple of those. You really changed that organization.
Well, in the first place, I had been around to a number of universities where they had performed The Crucible, and most of them, as a matter of fact, all the backstage people were in the drama department, not the opera department. And more of them, I found that the heads of those departments didn't speak to each other. So I thought, well, we couldn't have that here, what with a great dance department and the drama and all that. So we set up the School of Design and Production, which at this point has been the most completely successful department in the whole school. And there's still almost nothing like it.
I can speak to that myself, as in just dropping by the School for Design and Production and spending an afternoon with Cirque du Soleil,
yep.
who was there to recruit from the best of the world, which is UNCSA, thanks to that
yes.
vision.
Yes.
From going from your first opera, what did you learn from that, and how did you bring that into the Crucible?
The first place, I was fortunate enough to meet Bernard Stambler, who was head of the academic department at Juilliard. So it turned out he was an excellent writer, and as a boy, he had been in the claque at the Metropolitan, so he knew much more opera than I did. Anyhow, we got together. So from that point on, this was a tremendous learning experience for me.
Two of the major impacts on your writing came from one, Aaron Copland, and you referenced Paul Hindemith. Could you describe some of that back and forth between you and Aaron Copland and one aspect of your writing that you really attribute to his advice?
Oh, yes. Well, at the time that I was sort of coming up as a composer, there was a great split. Some people believed that everything had to be 12-tone, and Schoenberg was the great god there.
And we should explain for listeners who aren't musicians that by 12-tone we mean a sequence of 12 intervals that are mandated and sort of a method for composition.
Well, it's a method, but what's basic in it is that every thematic material has to have all of the 12 semitones, and then they are just repeated in kind of variations. Well, that's all right, but all great melodies aren't written in 12-tone moves. And then in Schoenberg's music, it got very dissonant and so very far ahead of anything else that was coming. Well, I got to know that music, but I didn't like it. But Copland had sort of started out more radical than he became in the later works when he sort of got involved with folk songs. And I loved that music. And then I studied with him, so I got to know it very well. So when I started to write my operas, I went back to my boyhood where I was a boy soprano, and I always started with the melodies, and that's, I think, the thing which has had more comment in my operas than anything else, is they sing.
Ah, Rebecca, how good of you to come. Francis Giles.
Good evening.
Good evening.
How does your Betty fare? We hear that she's ill.
The long lines that you established,
that's right. That's
I
right.
just found it very interesting that Aaron Copland actually suggested you move away from the piano in terms of your compositional
that's right.
approach.
Because I was not a very capable pianist at that time, but I would sit at the piano. But he listened to one of the first things of mine he ever judged, and he thought for a while. He never talked a lot until he had something really important to say. And he said to me, "Do you work at the piano all the time?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I do." And he said, "Well, I think you ought to get away from it." He said, "Because your sense of pitch and all those things is very good." But he said, "You try to write the whole score practically consecutively, and you just can't work very fast that way. There's too much involved." So at Tanglewood, where I was studying with him, you had to go out to a boys' school where we lived to get away from all the music going on around him. So I went out there every morning, sat on the porch, and it looked right out over the beautiful mountains in the central Massachusetts. And suddenly I was able to write 50, 60 bars at one sitting, and then I could go back and do the rest. So that was a real revolution in my whole composing career.
His ability to kind of lock yes. in on who you were as a person and as a composer, I just find really interesting.
That's true.
In terms of The Crucible, your initial reaction to Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible?
I had never been so moved by a play in my life. And I had seen a lot of plays because my older brother was on the staff at the Cleveland Playhouse. So I saw a lot of plays.
Synchronicity played a big part in your going from that play into the opera.
Yeah.
My understanding was that your initial opera kind of paved the way there in a sense. Hugh Gets Slammed.
Oh, yes.
How did that work?
Well, and Arthur Miller, since he had actually originally thought it might make a better opera than a play, he told me. So he started to think about writing because he was hearing music. He was a good friend of Mark Blitzstein. So he called him and he said, "Hey, Mark, how long will it take me to learn to write the music for an opera in this?" Mark thought a minute and he said, "Oh, hell, Arthur." He said, "How long did it take you to learn to write your plays?" And he said, "Oh, 10 years before I wrote the first good one." And Mark said, "Well, it'll take you at least that long again." And he picked up his phone and he said, "Thanks, Mark." And he put it down.
That's a great story.
And then he wrote the play.
So Arthur Miller, he essentially handpicked you to write the music to this, to write the
opera. Well, what happened, I handpicked to get to write it because I had gotten to the play for that time and I was just bowled over by it. And so it was a question of how do I get to him directly. I was able to do that. So he was very interested and he then was able to see my first opera. It was done at New York City Opera, and that really turned things over.
It sealed the deal.
Yeah.
Your association with librettist Bernard Stabler goes back a ways to the Juilliard days.
That's right.
What was the back and forth like between you and him during the process of writing this work?
Well, in the first place, Bernie, when he was in high school, he was in the claque at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. So he knew more opera than I knew. So when I learned about him and approached him with the possibility of working together, he was very excited about it. So right from the start, we worked very closely, and he had a family about the same size of mine. We became very good friends as well. He had all this knowledge of it, and I had the kind of musical abilities which I thought would work with opera, because I had sung in operettas in high school and so forth.
In terms of the back and forth then between you all and Arthur Miller, was there any, what sort of feedback were you getting along the way?
Well, before we got the rights, after we had explained what we wanted and so forth, he had seen, of course, our first opera, so he knew the kind of music I wrote. And then he said, "Do you suppose you could write a couple scenes that I could get some impression of the modern music you'd write for this?" So I said, "Fine." I wrote two scenes and got a soprano that I knew well and myself singing the baritone role. And we sang them for him. And he said, "That's it." And he called his agent immediately and said, "Get a contract signed here."
What did that feel like?
Yeah, that felt very good.
I can imagine.
And then Julius Rudell, who was head of the New York City Opera at that time, he was very interested because they were doing a whole series of American operas. So he set the time when he'd like to do it in about 10 months away. Well, that's a very short time to write an opera for anybody almost, except maybe Verdi. And, but we were so excited, we said, "We'll do our best."
"Ah, Rebecca, how good of you to come." Francis,
the Crucible set against the backdrop of 17th century Salem witch trials, but the play is really an allegory to the McCarthyism and the House Un-American Activities. Arthur Miller fell victim to this, to McCarthyism. What did he share with you about that time in his life?
Well, the way it all happened McCarthy was calling in all these people from Hollywood and so forth, and his questioning, a very important part, was, who did you meet with in all this time? And they would spell out all these names. Well, then when Aaron went to testify...
Are you talking about Aaron Copland, or you're talking about Arthur Miller?
Arthur Miller,
uh-huh. Yeah. Because Aaron was also
called
Aaron in front of the group.
Aaron was called, too.
Yeah.
And he said right off, he said, look, I'll tell you anything about my own association, but I will not answer any questions about the other. Well, McCarthy was furious. That's the way it all got started.
Renowned American composer, educator, and former University of North Carolina School of the Arts Chancellor, Dr. Robert Ward. He died last April at the age of 96. I spoke with him days before the Piedmont Opera and A.J. Fletcher Opera Institute's production of Ward's Pulitzer Prize-winning opera, The Crucible. You'll find links to more information about his life and music on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Well, that wraps up today's show. Our executive producer is David Ford. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Andre Wallace. If you missed part of today's episode or would like to share what you heard, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can find us on Twitter, too. Our handle is Triad Art Speak. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions to share, please send your email to triadarts@wfu.edu. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.